So what I want to look at, which some of you may find not so interesting, is if you're a student or if you're somebody working at the university, you think in terms of a relationship between two parties, the university and the student. Maybe there are other kinds of relationship, other stakeholders which need to be considered. And what are we going to be talking about in this presentation is the challenges that universities have to face when they're not just concerned with meeting the requirements of the government, but also the requirements of industry. How can we get a reasonable balance between these various demands, but also the demands of students? Students, in particular, mature students, have their own particular agendas, and it's increasingly challenging for those in tertiary education in universities to be all things to all people, to deliver the goods for these different kinds of expectations. So that's what I want to look at this morning. A little bit about who I am and what I do. I work full-time in Denmark in public service broadcaster. For those of you who know the BBC, that's like a very small BBC. So it's a public broadcaster, so it receives its money from a license fee. It doesn't receive it from advertising or from a subscription. Yeah, through an equivalent kind of tax. I'm concerned mainly with policy and strategic planning. And my main focus, but not my exclusive focus, is on digital television and broadband, but also increasingly on mobile and third or fourth generation delivery. You may think digital TV is completely irrelevant in the Hong Kong context, but perhaps after February 18th, you may realize that it isn't quite so strange, because that's the date on which Intelsat and TVB launched a new service into Hong Kong with 30 channels, five of which are new Cantonese channels. And from the first day, about 60,000 households will be able to receive it. They're expecting to challenge iCable and UCCW. They've got a very different strategy. So things are also happening here, which many people may not be familiar with. So, apart from working full-time in broadcasting, I also teach on postgraduate programs. I teach here once or twice a year, something which I find very useful and I also enjoy doing. I also teach about 120 hours a year at a new IT university in Copenhagen. I'll be talking more about that. I teach a few hours a year in Paris on a European master's program, and I also hope to do some work at a new research institute at Merle University in the autumn. I've talked something about this 3.5 years ago when I was invited to do a presentation at the 6th Worldwide Web Symposium here in Hong Kong. And at that time, I gave some preliminary results of what we've been doing at this new IT university in Copenhagen. What I can now talk about is some of the things that happened in the meantime and put it in a broader perspective. So what I'd like to do this morning is just tell you something about Denmark, something about the context in which the things that I'm going to be explaining take place. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the two places I work, both Danish Broadcasting, using the acronym DR here, and ITU, which is the IT University of Copenhagen. Then go on to talk about current political debates on the role of education as a means of assuring long-term economic growth, actually regarding it as investment and not just an expense. And also to explain to you the response which has taken place from universities and companies, how they're trying to achieve these things, and the kinds of difficulties they're still grappling with. So, the context, first of all, Denmark, my two employers. It's quite funny, sometimes I have to sit in government advisory panels. On occasions, both of my bosses, they're both my Director General for Broadcasting and the managing director, it's not called a vice chancellor, but the managing director of the IT university. So I have to have a meeting before we go into, say, the Minister of Culture, so to make sure that what I'm saying actually fits both of them. But fortunately, they work very closely together, and you hear why this is the case in about 20 minutes' time. You may not know very much about Denmark, and it'd be surprising if you did. So, a few background details: 5.4 million, so that's smaller than Hong Kong. You're about 7 million. It's a bit bigger than Hong Kong, 44,000 square kilometres. If we don't count Greenland, we also have a small island off the coast of Canada, which is about 1.2 million square kilometres. So it's a big place. Right now, because of the exchange rate, it looks as though we're pretty affluent. So GNP per capita is $43,000, multiply that by roughly 8 to get a sense of what we're actually earning. So because of the, if you take just the straight currency conversion, it seems that we're very rich. If you do a purchasing power parity conversion, then it doesn't look quite so impressive. We rank 5th on the Davos ranking of our IT nations, where I think Hong Kong is 16th in the figures from November, December. This isn't primarily because of business, it's primarily because we've been quite good at getting the population to use IT. So the reason why Denmark is that high up is we rank among the top 3 in terms of household use, not just penetration, but household use, broadband use of IT, of mobile and other things. We're not, it's not quite so impressive in other fields. We have 5 multi-faculty universities, and we've got another 11 specialist universities. So that brings that to 16. And ITU is one of these specialist universities, and I'll explain a little bit more about that later on. So, small place, but in terms of area, slightly bigger than Hong Kong. DR, Danish Broadcasting Corporation, it's an elderly company, and it's one of these dinosaurs that has to redefine itself to make sure it doesn't go extinct. Hopefully we're able to redefine ourselves, to re-engineer our organisation so we're still relevant to the needs of the 21st century society. We're 3,300 people, an annual operating budget of 4.4 billion Hong Kong dollars. We're funded by a broadcast license, as I said. That's a kind of a tax, just called something else. We have 2 TV channels, which have a 38% market share. We have a website, a portal, which is now the second biggest portal in Denmark, just after Microsoft. So we have, on a monthly basis, 2 million unique users, which sounds quite impressive for a population of 5 million, and until you realise that some of the users are offshore. They're both Danes living outside of Denmark, but increasingly they're Japanese and Americans who listen to our internet jazz channels. So we have more users for our jazz services from Japan and the USA than we do from Denmark when it comes to jazz.
Yeah. What do you say? 2 questions. Broadcast license. Does it mean anybody pay tax? They have to pay a broadcast license,
well,
or do we have to collect it?
We don't have to collect it. It's for us and the other public service broadcasters. There are 2 public service broadcasters. So there's an annual tax, which is called a broadcast license, for associated with being able to use a TV or radio.
Is it for household ones? They have to pay.
Not to us, to the license body, and they collect about the current exchange rate, 2,400 Hong Kong dollars a year per household, which is split between us and TV2, which is the other public service broadcaster.
So you don't have the situation then with these
little vans.
Vans being around
the corner. Oh, we do have protective vans because only about 89% of households pay, but 97% use. So 8% of the 97% households are using but not paying. But it's a reasonable figure. It's manageable. We have at the moment, I can't tell you the exact number because when it comes to radio, the number of channels we have is increasing. Radio is a very strange medium because we used to think of it to do with a radio set, but we have radio all sorts of places today. On radio, on digital television, on the web, on a digital radio, DAB, we have it all sorts of places, and sometimes we don't realise it is in fact a radio system, so we can actually transmit radio to all sorts of places. Radio in some European countries is in fact a growth area. It's also a growth area for advertising. We have a website, we have services on mobile platforms, we have a presence on at the moment four different digital television platforms, two satellite, one cable, one fiber to the home. So a media company. That's where we're at the moment, and that's Copenhagen. We're in north of Copenhagen, and there's a reason for showing that picture, because things are not staying the same. The IT University is just very near to the broadcasting centre. It was set up by a passing of a law in April 1999, and the institution started a few months later in August 1999. To begin with, it rented accommodation, and in fact by outsourcing some of the activities to for the first couple of years to universities in Denmark and in Sweden. It started off the first year with 200 students. Last year it had 627, this year it will have something like 800 students. They're not bachelor, they're masters or PhD students. Started off with a fairly small number of full-time staff, 37, it's grown to 82. This excludes about 60 people who work part-time. So we've got a fair number of external lecturers, a lot of people like myself. Most of these are from R&D environments in companies, so it's a way of cementing relationships between academic research, academic teaching, and what goes on in industry. I don't have the figure with me, I can find it. As I said, the university works with postgraduate and PhD only. It's steady state when it reaches it in a couple of years' time. It should be about 1,500 students at any given time. So this is one of the 11 specialist universities. That's its website. You can see that they're moving, and that's something I'll be talking more about. This is the organigram. This is how the place is organized. For the first 5 years, it's got a board of directors. This looks like a company, not like a university. It's got nine directors. Four of these are vice chancellors from other universities. Five of them are industrialists from a major IT, in one case, one minor IT company. And it's been very useful to have the competition actively engaged in it, that's to say, having. I think it's the cable. I think the competition is quite useful to have vice chancellors from competing universities on the panel, because we don't have a vice chancellor. We have at the moment a managing director, and he's a very energetic person. So often he's coming up with ways of doing things that the five multi-faculty universities haven't done. So often he'll be under a lot of constructive criticism, because they regard this both as an opportunity and as a threat. But if the university gets something right, then often this affords the opportunity for them going away and doing it. You know, imitation is the most sincere form of flattery. And on occasions when we've done something well at the IT university, then within a year, the other universities have been doing it too. So it's a mechanism for trying to generalize innovation within society.
But the managing director is from the commercial sector, or is he academic?
He's an academic. He's a bona fide academic who has worked for a few years in a startup and then he brought back again. But he came from, he's got a datalogical background and has a genuine track record as an academic. So we have four departments with rather strange looking names in English. So we've got Department of Theory, which but this is for Department of Theoretical Research, whereas all the other ones are very much looking at applied research. So innovation per se is a department.
Which department are you in?
The interesting thing is that we do have a school, which is the School of Design, Communication and Media, which is not, there isn't a one-to-one relationship for that particular group. It's the biggest school, and that's the only one which isn't directly related to a particular department. All of the other ones have in fact their own particular school. So we have five major schools with their own particular sets of modules. It's relatively small, and we'll be talking about later on, can you actually run a university with relatively few people in management? So far it's been, as I say, quite good to have that particular setup. And from now on, you're really welcome to ask questions as you go along. One of the things I try to highlight is what seems to be in fashion, certainly for the last 5 or 6 years, when we've been talking very much about the knowledge society. We've been through a phase with the Industrial Revolution looking into just producing things, to producing services, to developing know-how. What's happening in small countries, which are fairly affluent, is that they can't necessarily compete with things anymore. If you take Denmark, we're still well known for animation, for producing films. Disney at one point bought out a whole animation company from Denmark and took it to the States. When it comes to doing full-length animation films or short animations, what happens? The creative team is in Denmark, the project management team is in Denmark. All of the cell filling, the drawings on the sheets of cardboard, is done in the Pearl River Delta, in specialist workshops who have got the necessarily artistic skill to do it, but far lower labour costs. They don't have the quality assurance background. So that's why you have Danish project managers who work in Guangzhou or places like that with workshops which just do the basic work because of their labour costs, but also their artistic abilities, that kind of artistic ability. So we can survive by outsourcing certain kinds of activity to our parts of the world where the work can be done equally well but far cheaper. So in Denmark, outsourcing in IT and media is done primarily to India. Some of it's done in the Philippines. That's because of the high level of English and other languages. For example, when it comes to text inputting, OCR isn't always competitive with having it done in the Philippines, where they actually have people who can actually read Danish and input Danish. But some of the more artistic things are actually done in China now. Toy production. We were one of the top 10 toy manufacturers in Denmark. But that's for designing them, but most of the toys are actually produced in China or Vietnam. So Denmark survives on its brains, some of the successes in Denmark in the last few decades, well, last decades. You may not realize that Denmark is responsible for half of the world market for insulin. That position may not stay, and therefore the company behind it has to invest something like $2 billion Hong Kong dollars a year in R&D in the biotech field. We've got 35% of the whole world market for windmills. Two Danish companies which recently merged are the biggest manufacturers of windmills producing electricity. We're a major exporter to the US, so there are more Danish windmills in the US than there are American windmills. This is a byproduct of an R&D program which started about 25 years ago. We've got one or two major successes in digital content. I've chosen this one. We measure success not primarily by awards at trade shows and competitions, but in terms of their success in the market. We do quite well in trade shows, but it's probably more important to take something like this product, which sold 2.5 million copies in 1 month, not in Denmark, because the market in Denmark is insignificant. Like, sold 2 million copies in the first month in the US and sold 300,000 in the UK. So it's probably important to have honest benchmarks when you're looking at performance and not just look at soft ones like awards at trade shows. They're useful indicators of creativity, but not necessarily honest indicators of performance. And then we've got startups such as Giga, Maconomy, and Radiometer. Giga was sold just over 2 years ago for 5.5 billion Hong Kong dollars to Microsoft. No, to Intel. It's a world leader in gigabit speed communications. It was a startup from the Technical University. So it was spun off the Technical University about 1994-95. And it grew phenomenally and was sold in 2001 to Microsoft. Maconomy was sold to Microsoft, and that was called Microsoft Denmark. That's got a substantial part of the world market for account systems, bookkeeping systems in the world market. Radiometer is a biotech company which has redefined itself. It was set up about 25 years ago by one man. His kids don't want to take it over, so he's recently sold out. We've got more examples, but these are three or four of the major ones, but all of these sold for between 3 to 5 billion Hong Kong dollars. They've been sources of employment in Denmark. So we can say these successes, why can't we just rest on our laurels? We're doing all right, aren't we? Well, I don't think so. Once you sell a company like that, if you sell an IT startup, which has become quite big, you sell a biotech company, ultimately it leads to a risk that the R&D environments won't necessarily stay where they are. They'll often go to where the owners live. But in the case of Giga, Intel said it was going to keep its R&D team in Denmark. What did they do? It took about a year and they fired the researchers and then moved it and set up their own new Giga R&D environment in the US. You haven't any guarantees that things will be as they have been said by the company. So it's a problem if you don't continue to generate high quality, world class innovations which can lead to startups, which can continue to do IPOs, initial public offerings, and so on. We've got a very no undeniable proportion of the population were skilled and willing enough to set up their own companies with high R&D profiles. Quite a lot of people want to go into low, medium skill service operations, but not enough in the things which have got a high knowledge content, which are R&D based. So overall, only about 3% of the native population want to set up their own company, which is very, very low. Take a country like Brazil, it's about 14%. And take the US, it's about 10 to 11%. If we're going to survive, it's not enough for all of us to be working in fairly safe jobs in the public sector. We need to have a bigger proportion working in the private sector. And if we've been honest, we've been talking now around the world for about maybe 20 years. Perhaps we can go back as early as 1969, the need to shift the focus of attention from just good initial tertiary education to a mix of good initial tertiary education and lifelong education and training provisions, teaching and learning provisions which were in a society where change is an everyday phenomenon. We can't assume that the skills and the knowledge we have when we graduate will still be relevant to us even 10 or 15 years down the line. So we have to look at how we can have a learning base to society. This doesn't necessarily mean that everybody has to go back to school or university all of the time. I mean, learning takes place on its own in spite of governments, not just because of them. So, but it's the balance between what is done in public and private education and what learning takes place quite naturally through people's own networks and by things they do on their own. Much of learning takes place in networks, knowing people who can help you come to terms with new things. My claim is that much of what we've been doing for the last two decades has been paying lip service to this. We haven't got very far, certainly in Denmark. We've got quite far in the commercial field, so things like MBAs, you can do commerce diplomas, and the take-up has been quite dramatic. Where we used to have almost exclusively full-time courses, now these are part-time under the provisions of the Open Education Act in Denmark. So it's probably about 4% of the population doing some sort of tertiary level commerce-related training and doing that on 20-25 hours a week. But it isn't flexible enough. We've seen for the five multi-faculty universities, they've been good at initial education and provisions, but being a mixed mode, both initial training and lifelong institution, they haven't really been good enough at having a culture which is also good at looking after the interests and needs of mature students. So, and also they have the difficulty that the government often has success criteria for their performance criteria which are difficult. So I can give you an example. One of my students, where I teach at the IT University, went away with a project she'd been working on and did a pitch, a presentation to a company. The problem was the company was so impressed that she didn't come back again. So they hired her as a project manager for a new R&D program for digital television on the content side. And she just needed to do a dissertation. She figures in the statistics as a failure because she's dropped out. In terms of society and innovation, I think that's a bit too harsh. She'll come back and do a dissertation at some point, but at the moment it figures as a failure for that particular university. We've got a lot of mature students who don't necessarily want to complete a master's, but they want to come in on an ongoing basis do one or two modules to upgrade areas they feel they're not good enough at doing, are coping within their work. They won't necessarily have the time or the need to do a full master's. They want an a la carte menu and not a fixed menu. so often they do it, and again, because of the nature of the performance criteria, which are still largely geared to initial university education, those universities who do a good job of delivering this get penalized because their performance is measured on throughput. What are their inputs? What are their outputs? The mechanisms for assessing their performance are too general to pick up this kind of thing. The other thing is, I've read the merits about throughput. We've also got, certainly in Denmark, some of the short bachelor level courses. We've got examples of something like the multimedia design program, which produces 4,000 graduates a year. We don't have any need for 4,000 graduates a year with that sort of low-level knowledge and skill base. And the department responsible for this said, well, this is the market will adjust. I don't think that's good enough. I think there should be some sort of consultation so you don't have an overproduction of underqualified people. At the same time, we are not good enough at increasing the proportion of PhDs, because if we're looking at the long term, it's that kind of R&D we're concerned about, not just something which will deliver the goods in 12 to 36 months. It's some of these world-class innovations, real breakthroughs, which are going to create wealth by allowing us to set up a company which will be doing something completely new. So that's why they're the same as here, development programs in nanotechnology, a lot of money in biotech, discussion about other areas. That's what I'm coming to. Some other problems. The government has decided they're going to increase spending on higher education at the same time making cuts. That might sound familiar. I think in the beginning of the 21st century, this isn't uncommon. You can actually see budget increases and budget cuts at the same time. It needn't be completely incoherent and inconsistent. I think it's fair for society at large to say, what are we getting out of the money we're spending on education? Certainly, what are we getting out of research? What are we getting out of education? It's fair to look at mechanisms for increasing not just efficiency, but effectiveness. And then the whole business of effectiveness is, for example, the measure where in Hong Kong there's been a discussion as to whether universities should be paid for the proportion of their graduates who actually get gainful employment. This is an attempt to look at a measure, not of efficiency, of effectiveness. How good is the match between what is offered and what is required by the labour market? But I think it's a bit dubious because the labour market is extremely cyclical. It's very much related to the state of the global economy. I mean, when the world gets a cold, so Hong Kong gets influenza, not Asian flu, but avian flu. But if there's minor changes in the world economy, this has a big impact on the economic climate in Hong Kong. And often, if your throughput is 3 to 5 years, if you've got both a bachelor and also a master, you're planning things 5 years ahead, and unless you've got a very good crystal ball, you can't actually know what the economic situation is going to be when your graduates actually get onto the labour market. So discussions of that kind I find rather difficult, and we've had similar ones in Denmark too. So that kind of thing is a challenge. Yeah, the other one seems to be almost universal, ill-defined expectations about investment in education and economic growth. This general thing, we throw money at higher education and it has to deliver the goods in terms of economic growth. It's not always careful enough. If you look at the research on what it takes to be successful as an innovator to set up your own company, it's very rare to find any public program which is particularly successful. It's often easier to have indirect activities in changing, providing incentives for taxation and things of that kind, rather than government interfering in certain areas. Probably the most difficult area was, for example, both at national and at European level. We've been discussing the digital entertainment field now for at least 6 years, and the last 2 years we've been talking about games industry. Well, governments and development programs and games are completely incompatible. If you look at the life cycle of a game, it's typically, it's got a development cycle of something like 12 months, another 6 months of validation along with the publisher. It's very, very difficult to reduce the production cycle. In some cases, it's 24 months. If you look at one of the most dynamic markets around the world, which is the UK, over the last 18 months, the number of companies working in games has dropped from about 250 to about 110, 120. There's been a considerable concentration. Yeah, the turnover of the companies that still remain have gone up. So it's about 15 or 20% higher than it was last year. But in order to survive, you've got to live in a rapid growth environment. And we're talking about one company in 5,000 having a success. This is a typical figure for games. One company in 5,000. The other 4,000 or so either go bust or they have a modest success. They can just about break even, or they're part of companies which do not just games but other kinds of animations. And they have to be extremely responsive to changes in the market. Can you imagine any government program in any country which can be responsive in terms of weeks or months? I find that so rather difficult to understand. And yet, in Denmark we had a report about this. But fortunately, they concluded that it would be better to try and do some things at university level and not try and tinker with the industry per se. But if you read this particular report, it's very interesting and it's got a lot of useful information. I'm concerned that that public initiatives in this particular field won't necessarily have the impact that they require. And I think things like the cyberport really have to be thought out very carefully. Is that the kind of environment for a startup? Startups in many other parts of the world like to start up with other companies of the same kind, often in fairly low cost accommodation. If you're talking about big companies, okay, they can afford to move into cyberport, but what are the synergies of being together? You have to look at that quite closely. But for small startups, it's probably not the right place to be if you're in the digital entertainment field. You want to be with all the other companies we've worked with like that. So it'd probably be more interesting to be near TVB and ATV on another part of Hong Kong Island rather than in premises which look impressive but may not provide you with the kinds of networking and inputs you would need to do a good job. We do exactly the same. Make the same sort of mistake in Denmark. I'm sure this takes place all over the place, but it's difficult. It's difficult because the government has to do something, but is it going to be successful in what it does? Just talk about some of the vision and realities from Denmark. This is just to explain who these people are. This is the Minister of Science, Technology and Innovation on the left. There's the chairman of the board of the IT University, and here's the managing director, Mads Tofte. This is on September 26th, and the event was IT receiving the award for the university which have done the most to help out startups. Anderson Wang. As a teaser, I included some general statistics in the post. So, while they're still studying at IT, 11.5% are in the have actually already set up a company. So, none, hardly any of them done before. But in the 2 years that they're there, one in nine actually set up a company while they're actually still studying. There's an additional 27% who are actually actively planning this, not while they're studying, but after they're studying. So we can't actually manage to do a full-time degree course and also start on a company. So the potential is about 10 times the national average. I'm going to be finished in about 2 minutes. The potential is about 1 in 3. It's 10 times the national average. That doesn't mean we've changed attitudes, but we've certainly attracted many of those who are actually interested in this kind of thing. And the IGU, certainly since I spoke about the place 3.5 years ago, after the first year, in fact preempting a recent major international evaluation of the IGU, has realigned its research areas to focus on fewer strategic areas which can get better support. So there's fewer but bigger teams working on, one of which is computer games, or electronic games, because it's not just computers. They've got quite good links with industry, but they could be better in some areas for research, and certainly for education. We don't use our links for well enough, to we don't make good enough use of the industrialists who could in fact help us as external lecturers. The management team, the core management team of this place is only about 12 people. It was okay when they had 200 students. When you end up with 1,500 students, can you run an institution with 12 people? Probably not. That's what the international evaluation concluded. It said something's got to be done to help the first core team, which have certainly delivered the goods, but is it appropriate to continue with the nine directors on the board, four of whom are vice chancellors? Is that still necessary? It was good in the startup phase, but perhaps changes in the composition of the board are needed. The managing director or vice chancellor probably needs a stronger team to be able to handle these things. It's been delivering the goods in terms of research and industry. The problems to do with the targets for diploma courses and for master's courses for those who are in gainful employment. From what I can see, teaching on the program here, there's a culture problem in Denmark. They need to have two different kinds of internal culture. One for fairly young students doing their initial degree course, and a completely different service-oriented culture for mature students. More flexible, more options for doing fully taught courses, options for just doing particular modules. Flexibility is the key word here. I don't think an institution which has grown out of running courses for full-time students, it has the necessary mindset, the necessary level of service to do a good job for those who come in from commerce and industry. I think compared with the program run from Graduate House, they could really learn a lot in just a few days of looking at many of the things you've got right here. You certainly have a very different culture, and I think that's a very critical thing. Core courses, performance criteria, you get penalised for, as I said earlier, for students who do what they require or what their employers require, but not what the payment system requires. So, as it's payment by results, payment for every student who actually completes a module and passes the formal assessment. If people actually get what they need out of it, but they don't help out by doing the formal assessment, then as the whole payment system is geared to the throughput, but then you run into difficulties. There's also other weaknesses in terms of links to other universities. The ITU really needs to have better links to the Copenhagen Business School and to other, say the London Business School in certain areas of its core competences, because it doesn't have all of the market skills it needs. It's got the technical and the design skills, but it doesn't necessarily have all the market skills, and therefore there could be synergies for its educational provisions if they spend a little more time with strategic alliances with other institutions. And then the last 2 minutes, I'll just take you through some of the things that are happening at DR. So why do I keep on mentioning DR and the RT University? Well, in about 1 minute you'll realise. This is a picture of the last greenfield site in the centre of Copenhagen. It's down here, this green area here, and it's literally 3 kilometres from the very centre of Copenhagen. This is an area of common land which has just been fallow for ages. This is now being developed. At DR, what we've been doing for the last 10 years is increasing our productivity about 6 to 8% per annum. So we now produce about twice the amount of television for the same inputs, twice the amount of radio for the same inputs. You can get so far just by working harder, but at some point you've got to increase productivity by working in a more intelligent fashion. And we came to a decision, a collective decision, about 3.5 years ago that we weren't going to be able to deliver that kind of productivity increase anymore just by working harder. People were beginning to get a bit stressed. So we decided we needed to work in a new way. One of the ways for doing this is actually saying, okay, we've got to have an incentive to do things differently. We've sold our television centre, we've sold our radio centre, we've sold 10 other premises in the Copenhagen area. We're all moving into a new media village, which allows us to start from scratch, to rethink what it means to produce electronic media in the 21st century. So, a lot of other companies are moving to Nokia's research team, one of the telcos research teams is moving into this area. The RT University is going to be our next door neighbour here. The University of Copenhagen is right, Copenhagen is next door, so we can suddenly have some synergies for our courses, even our physical taught courses, because we're all within 200 metres of each other. So this is the building site. There's the new light railway, which is fully automated, no drivers. This is the IT University as it looked a couple of months ago, going up. We're burning our bridges to ensure improved flexibility and the ability to cope with change in the 21st. There's no going back. By selling our buildings, selling our infrastructure, saying, we'll look at the future. Everybody has to look at the future. Everybody has to say, okay, what's life going to be like in 2010? Certainly, what's life going to be like in 2006 when we move? Then everybody knows that things are never going to be the same. It represents the promise of doing things in a different way, hopefully a more intelligent way, hopefully a less stressful way. So together, we've had about 200 people working on the specific analysis and design of how we're going to be working in the medium to long term. And this is now a bit too done. We've also got a new concert hall, one of the best in Europe for doing direct broadcasts from classical music. So this is the new light railway. This is where DR is here. This is the new concert hall. Over here is the IT University. This is the consumer body in Denmark, for consumerism is important. This is the University of Copenhagen. Along here and down here we've got centres from Nokia, TDC, CSC, their research centres. So we're suddenly in walking distance from some of the people we'd like to be. So in the future, in 2 years' time, I can walk from doing my office job in broadcasting 50 metres and go over and teach in another building for my other boss. If you want, there's a program. The other response is we've set up a joint venture. So all of the technology partners living in this part of this new area haven't been forced to do so, but we've got together as a sort of housing association and decided to set up a joint venture, a forum where we'll be doing applied research together. So industry, the universities, also the business school, in fact, have got together. We're going through this big challenge, cultural challenge of learning to speak the same language, learning to explore common ground and set up shared medium to long term R&D projects. We haven't got there yet. It's very, very difficult learning to speak the same language, but this hasn't been imposed on us. We've chosen to do so. So going back again, in that area, this particular area, we've got an R&D project because there's also some new flats, houses. We'll be looking at geographically based services, an R&D program, where we can do tests on the 20,000 people who live and work in that area. So they'll all be equipped with a 3G or 4G device where we can test out positioning services. Nokia's interested, obviously. So, just to round up and to say, we've got a few things right, we've got most things wrong. What's important is to be honest about when you get things wrong, to stop and say, why are we getting it wrong? Where can we pick off some things which are really badly wrong, which we can do something about? And as I say, we're moving from a situation where we're not just concerned between taking two to tango, just thinking about two in this, but a triangular relationship between universities on the one hand and government on the other, universities and industry and government, but at the microscopic level, looking at what happens at faculty level and what happens with the student. So that we end up being a bit more sensible, a bit more flexible, and we come up with solutions which will be appropriate to the 21st century, which will allow Denmark to survive as a relatively affluent country. If we don't get it right, we'll see our standards of living starting to decline, which we won't be able to compete. Thank you.